in a number of clean energy spaces, from clean vehicles to building standards to appliance standards, you name it. California's always been at the forefront of that leadership, saying we can grow our economy and achieve our clean energy goals simultaneously. One of the glaring absences has been in the community solar space, and we've let other states really kind of take the lead. New York has been a true leader in community solar.
Hello and welcome to the Solar Maverick podcast, where solar meets entrepreneurship and experience. I'm your host, Benoit Thanjan, so let's get into it.
Hi, this is Benoit, your host of the Solar Maverick podcast. I'm excited in this podcast. We have a group of people actually on the podcast. We have Derek Chernoff from CCSA, Steve Campbell for Vote Solar, and Stephanie Doyle from SIA. And we're actually having an interesting discussion about what's happening with the California Community Solar Program. Last month, California Public Utilities Commission issued a proposed decision that sides with California's major utilities against the broad coalition for community solar that involved the net value billing tariff. And this has caused a lot of uncertainty with the California market. A lot of the solar community was excited for this program, which potentially could have been around 7 to 8 gigawatts of solar and provide lower electricity costs for low moderate income housing, and also create grid reliability with community solar, with solar plus storage. I really appreciate you all being here. It's something that the whole industry is talking about. I think the best way to start is maybe if all three of you could give a brief introduction. Do you want to start, Derek?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Benoit. I appreciate you having the Coalition for Community Solar Access, or CCSA, represented here today. CCSA has been around now for about a decade, and we're the trade association for community solar companies all around the country. So we're operating now in over 20 states throughout the U.S. Community solar is the fastest growing segment of the solar industry, and CCSA represents that entire value stack: developers, subscription managers, financiers, law firms, the whole gamut. And really what we're trying to do is continue to expand and open up those markets all throughout the U.S. We're at a great time here in this nation where we've got a presidential administration that's on board with community solar, that understands the value and is really doing everything that they can to make this push and increase the capacity and the number of households subscribed to community solar. So we're at an exciting time, but in each state there is a challenge, and California is no different.
That's a great introduction, Derek. I appreciate CCSA for organizing this panel. And Stephanie, it would be great if you could introduce yourself and SIA.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. I'm Stephanie Doyle. I'm the California Director for SIA, the Solar Energy Industries Association. And SIA is the national trade group for the solar industry. We represent all sectors from utility scale, community, rooftop, as well as batteries, manufacturing, and really everything in between. We work at the federal and state level to advance policies to support the solar and storage industry. And we've worked for years in California, both at the legislative and regulatory level, to address policy issues here in the state. And community solar has been one of our major efforts the last couple of years. So excited to be here to talk about it.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you, Stephanie, for making time to be part of the podcast today. And Steve, can you talk about your background and Vote Solar?
Sure. So thanks for having me, and happy Friday, all. Name's Steve Campbell from Vote Solar. Vote Solar was founded in 2002 and advocates for clean energy in front of state houses and regulatory agencies, because I think we all know that's where all the power and decisions are made. We use a combination of regulatory expertise, coalition building, and public engagement to advance equitable policy.
Thank you, Steve, for being on the podcast. You know, we have a wide range of listeners who listen to the podcast. So I think the best way to start off is, can someone talk about briefly the community solar legislation that was proposed? And then we could go into the PUC's decision and how that impact that potential program.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. And I'll let Stephanie and Steve fill in the blanks that I'm sure I'll leave here. But, you know, California's got about a decade, a failed track record in community solar. We've had enabling legislation for a long time, and it really hasn't taken off and scaled and provided the depth of benefits that community solar is able to. And so in 2022, Assemblymember Chris Ward out of San Diego introduced Assembly Bill 2316. And what that did is twofold. It asked the Public Utilities Commission to take a look at current programs, evaluate them, and if they're not working, take the second step, which is enable a community renewable energy program that does scale up, that meets all these criteria, such as 51% have to be low to moderate income subscribers. It must include storage. It's got to take advantage of federal and state incentives and a number of other things. And so that bill went through the legislature rather rapidly and got signed into law at the end of 2022 by Governor Newsom as part of his climate change package of legislation. So it wasn't just kind of signed in a vacuum. It was signed purposely and intently as part of a climate change list of priorities. 18 months later, we've gone through the Public Utilities Commission, through the regulatory process, gone through hundreds and hundreds of pages of testimony and work papers. And finally, the Public Utilities Commission issued a decision last month. And the decision was rather unfortunate. After CCSA and our coalition partners, including SEIA and Vote Solar and so many others, has supported a net value billing tariff, which would have assuredly allowed that scalability, which would have guaranteed minimum savings for low-income subscribers, which would have included storage so we can put those clean electrons on the grid when we need it most. The PUC in this proposed decision went the opposite direction and said, no, we're going to continue to institute failed policies that we know nobody's interested in. We're not going to get developers who are interested in it. It's not going to, you know, create the types of projects, and we're not going to see the benefits that community solar and storage can provide. So it really went the opposite direction of where we all had thought and worked tirelessly to get to. And so now we find ourselves in a position where we've got to not overturn, but really get the PUC to see the error of that proposed decision and rewrite it before it comes to the commission for a full vote.
That's a great summary of it, Derek. Thank you. Especially as there's so much that's involved in it. Can you talk about how, I guess, everyone's expectation was that there was going to be an approval of this program? How has the industry reacted to the decision that was made just last month in the beginning of March?
Yeah, thank you. And I'll just say for the members of CCSA, we were optimistic that we can get a program built on the net value billing tariff that was widely supported from ratepayer advocates to labor to environmental justice groups to the building industry, an unparalleled coalition of advocates and organizations that typically don't see eye to eye on a lot of things, but came together in support of this net value billing tariff. We anticipated that in fairly short order, we can get 8 gigawatts of community solar and storage up and running in pretty quick order without major additions to the grid, right? These are all things that can be put on the distribution grid in fairly short order. And that would help with grid reliability and resiliency. It would help drive down, you know, costs, which are so critical right now in California, as well as provide a number of other clean energy benefits. So again, you know, we thought that we put really compelling proposal out there, that we took the time and effort to get support from a broad array of organizations, and we're still going to work hard to make sure that it's done right.
Yeah, and I can speak from SEIA's perspective a bit on the industry side. I think it's important to note that the PD, the proposed decision, would adopt a community solar tariff that uses the current PURPA compliant tariffs as a foundation. And we believe that means it's essentially dead on arrival. And that's because as it's written, it can't support the financing, development, and operation of community solar projects in California. And I would note too that the adoption of the PURPA-based tariff would be the second time that the commission has advanced a community solar program that really has no chances of success or ability to scale. And beyond that, provide no ability to provide relief to ratepayers and be delivering a program that does nothing to help our low-income households and families in California at a time when affordability is really critical here. So the PD as written is really, we think it's not going to result in any projects, which is really disappointing.
Definitely, that's really helpful, Stephanie. Steve, do you want to talk about Vote Solar support of AB 2316 and the net value billing tariff, or NVBT, in California? Sure.
Yes, thanks. So in addition to what both, you know, Derek and Stephanie said, I'll actually put a little bit more context to some of the broad coalition work that we've had here. So this actually emerged from Net Energy Metering. And I mentioned that to get you likes and to get you views, because Net Energy Metering will do so. And it's a separate conversation, so we can all come back and talk about that. But in any event, there's many coalitions and advocacy groups and regulatory experts in the net energy metering proceeding beginning in 2019. And so let's say 10 of those parties, and most of them had differing opinions on what California should do in the future. All 10 of those parties roughly agreed that California should have a community solar tariff founded upon the net value billing tariff coming out of net energy metering. So there was a lot of discussion and regulatory work done over a period of 3 to 4 years in the prior NEM 2 decision that resulted in what we have today, the net billing tariff. And many of those parties disagreed. And that can't be stressed enough, because that's typically my experience in regulatory work, is the best recommendations are put forward from the perspective of each advocacy organization. The judge and the commission listens to them and then comes out with a proposed decision that is supposed to kind of more or less obviously meet law, but make all parties have satisfactory, honestly listen to the recommendations and then implement that according to law. And so we didn't agree in them, but like I said, it can't be stressed enough that we all agreed here on the net value billing tariff. And that is very, very powerful. Typically is a very, very powerful coalition when you have a broad array of parties who typically or sometimes disagree, who all agree on something from different perspectives. And so it's also a lot of work. And when you have different perspectives on how law should be implemented, that's a lot of regulatory expertise on each perspective. And so when you have a very broad coalition, everybody's sort of covering everybody's flank. If I have a blind spot, somebody might be covering it to my left. If somebody else has a blind spot, then maybe a more moderate position has the expertise to fill in. So we had that here with net value billing tariff, and we had that with 2316. And so we were very confident in the expertise and the broad array of perspectives being covered that this 2316 would result in the net value billing tariff, would result in 8 gigawatts of community solar and storage throughout this decade. So I back up and kind of bring you that context, because it's been going on now for 4 to 5 years. We see this proposed decision not quite respecting, I would say, that level of prior engagement and work that all of these parties have done in good faith together. And so now we're at this position now where we have a proposed decision that sort of threw the baby out with the bathwater a little bit. And I'm sure we'll get into the PURPA compliance issues or interpretation issue. But there's a lot of good work that had been done that if had it been listened to a little bit more, and I think there's still time, and we'll talk about how to engage more people to speak up. But there's still a viable tariff there on the record that could be modified, that could result in a lot of gigawatts and community solar and storage. So I just wanted to provide a little bit of that long-standing context, and then we can talk about how to move forward.
This episode of the Solar Maverick podcast is brought to you by Podcast Laundry, the podcast concierge service that I use to make sure that my listeners hear the best quality show. They do the dirty work of podcasting for me. Yes, graphics, quotes, show notes, master editing, and much more. All I have to do is record. So if you're a busy podcaster like me with an engaged audience and want to free up time to do more of what you love to do, like going to the gym or spending time with loved ones, go to podcastlaundry.com to schedule your consultation or call 347-871-8273. That's podcastlaundry.com or 347-871-8273. Thank you.
Yeah, that is really helpful to understand that. And it's interesting about, you talk about Steve PURPA, Stephanie mentioned it as well. It doesn't seem, obviously, that many projects in California, or very few, have been developed under PURPA. Can someone like talk to that and maybe like why the California PUC decided to not, I know there was like language related to, and I know this got a lot of people's attention, that it was something unconstitutional, you know, for us lay people out there who are not sophisticated and working every day in it. It would be great to like get your perspective as experts in the industry and advocacy in California, which is unique into itself.
Yeah, I'll start out and Steve and Stephanie can add some context here as needed. But what the proposed decision did, it really overreached in a lot of respects. I mean, a lot. And one of which was it basically ruled that the NVBT, the net value billing tariff, was illegal, that this was a wholesale and should be applied under FERC, the federal jurisdiction, not state jurisdiction. This is completely contrary to what exists in every other state that has community solar or community solar programs. So it went really overreached, and not just referencing potential federal law, but actually making a decision from this particular proposed decision that this was illegal under federal law. And since then, we've actually had two former chairs of FERC both come out and say, no, this is actually not a FERC issue, that this is within the state's jurisdiction, that this portion of the proposed decision is completely in error. Not one, but two different former FERC chairs. And the reason that this was a very dangerous component for us in California was if it would have stood, these projects would have been compensated under PURPA, which has never been a vehicle for a viable community solar program in California. In fact, the last time that a PURPA project came online in California was a small hydropower plant in 2017. And there've only been two solar projects to come online under PURPA in the entire history of California, the last one being over 10 years ago. So this was never designed to be a PURPA type situation. If you want to guarantee that we're going to have a continued legacy of failed community solar programs, this proposed decision was the way to go. However, again, there's still time to get it right. But I think the important part was that proposed decision had some national implications. And that's why we saw a letter signed by over 30 CEOs with their company saying, hey, look, we're ready to invest $16 billion plus in California for these projects and this development. However, if this proposed decision stands, we're taking that investment capability elsewhere. We're looking at other states and really focusing our investment in those places. So, you know, again, we think at the end of the day that the Public Utilities Commission will see the error of that and rule that these are not, in fact, FERC-related projects, but actually within California's jurisdiction, just like we've seen in 20 plus other states that have a viable community solar program.
And so what's the time frame for that? I think that would be helpful, like the context. Obviously, that was decided in March. I've heard there's different dates. Can someone talk about that and what's the next step of the process? And
yeah, sure. So the last round of comments and testimony on the record were submitted April 2nd, and those were called reply comments. So we're kind of through the official testimony phase right now. And the first opportunity that the Public Utilities Commission has to vote on this proposed decision is coming right around the corner. It's April 18th. And what we've been urging the PUC to do, and when I say we, I mean, it's been, again, this broad coalition, including SEIA and Vote Solar, and political leaders are now urging the PUC to do the same thing here, which is hold off on the vote. Do not vote. Take the time to get it right. Take the time to rewrite this proposed decision and really put in a program that's based on the net value billing tariff that's going to ensure that scalability. The unique thing about this proposed decision is that it's really turned this issue into a bipartisan, you know, even more broadly supported effort on behalf of the net value billing tariff in opposition to the proposed decision. So it's really galvanized people that hadn't been involved in this matter previously are now getting involved. And we just saw a Republican legislator come in support of the net value billing tariff and in opposition to this proposed decision yesterday. So these are happening in real time now where folks and organizations that had been kind of keeping an eye on it from a distance are now actually getting involved and engaged in a very constructive manner. But again, that this proposed decision has galvanized the opposition to that PD and support of the net value billing tariff.
Yeah, and I could just add on there too, is Derek had mentioned that the commission may vote next Thursday on this proceeding, but it's really not that uncommon for commissions to have 30 agenda items on the docket and multiple of those agenda items to be held. And it really happens every month. So all we're really asking for the commission to do is do something they do frequently, which is, you know, just readjust what they've worked on. Sort of a proposed decision can be looked at as like a first draft of history. We don't think that that first draft of history is going to work for a good future. So it's really, we're just asking to take more time to listen to the amount of, you know, positive, intelligent, and expert voices that have weighed in California, including Derek mentioned the two commissioners. They did this day in, day out for years. And so they have the good expertise here to recommending to the commission to take more time. And so we're doing the same for more of the grassroots level. So votesolar.org will, you know, we have a large email list. We submit comments to the commission directly ourselves with our coalition partners, but then we also encourage people to get involved directly with the commission, which you can do in this case. And if you go to our website, we let you know how to do that. So it's really kind of just grassroots support, but also, you know, former FERC level commissioner support, saying that this just simply needs more time. It's something that the commission does frequently, so we should be doing it here.
That is really helpful. I really appreciate you talking about that, Steve, and obviously keeping your constituents educated. That's smart with the newsletter, and it sounds like things are happening pretty quickly. You guys are in the middle of it. How does this actually hinder the state's goals? You know, California has very ambitious goals for clean energy and is looked at as like the pioneer in clean energy compared to other states. Without this community solar program, you're talking about 7 to 8 gigawatts of potential community solar projects. How does that impact the California solar market going forward?
Yeah, I can start there. You know, SEIA really sees community solar as fitting in really well to the landscape here in California. We know we need to meet some really impressive clean energy goals, like you mentioned, over the next decade and even in the next 6 years by 2030. And we think community solar can really help with some of the issues we're seeing around build out from timeline perspectives and filling in some of those land gaps between big projects and small rooftop, and allowing access for folks that haven't had access to solar benefits previously. And particularly if the commission ends up adopting some form of the net value billing tariff that requires batteries with every project, we know that projects can help dramatically with our resource adequacy issues here in the state, serving as load reduction projects and providing resilience at a time when the state needs to be putting more projects online to reduce our need for gas peaker plants in those late evening hours. And really, we know we need all types of solar energy to reach our goals in the state. And by not setting up a program that allows for community solar to grow here, we think we're really trying to solve this bigger issue of reducing our emissions with a tool glaringly missing from our toolkit, really.
Yeah, definitely. And does that have national implications as well? You know, if California doesn't have a community solar program, maybe that changes what other states may not want to do community solar going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think as Stephanie was saying, California has so long been a leader in a number of clean energy spaces, from clean vehicles to building standards to appliance standards, you name it. California has always been at the forefront of that leadership, saying we can grow our economy and achieve our clean energy goals simultaneously. One of the glaring absences has been in the community solar space, and we've let other states really kind of take the lead. New York has been a true leader in community solar, and other states throughout the country. California can reclaim that mantle of leadership with a community solar and storage program that can scale up, but everybody's keeping eyes on California. And for good reason, not just the size of our market, but the fact that we are including storage, the fact that California had the most ambitious, you know, low-income subscription percentage of all states with our 51% requirement here in California, all these things once again showed that California can be a leader, but we can't get there with a proposed decision. It's like the federal goals can't be met without California, and California simply can't meet its goals with this proposed decision. It's as simple as that. But it takes an all-of-above approach, and community solar does have a role to play in that.
I would add, too, I think one part of the NVBT that I have found really unique, I don't know if it's unique, but that CCSA really took a lot of the lessons learned from other states to help craft this proposal in a way that kind of learned from what other states have done on community solar, because California hadn't been a leader, which is sort of not the usual way things work. Usually California goes first and others follow. But I think because we've had the opportunity to learn what works in other states, what makes things easy for subscribers, what makes projects more viable for developers and financiers, it's a really missed opportunity to not lean into those lessons learned and put forward this program.
That's very helpful. And I appreciate you both explaining. What about consumer choice? I mean, you know, obviously a lot of low, moderate income customers, people who can't get rooftop solar, meaning, you know, tenants and buildings. Like, obviously, with not having a community solar program, how does that impact, like, customers? Yeah,
sure. So, you know, California decision makers and policymakers should really be exceptionally happy that the majority of Californians want clean energy and they want clean energy quickly. It is also a fact, though, that a lot of Californians, roughly 50%, don't own their own house and will not be able to access solar that way. So that is a lot of Californians that you know want solar and they want it immediately. They want to power their lives with clean energy. And that is a wonderful achievement of California policy work to date. But We can't get there, obviously, without filling in the gap, as Stephanie and Derek mentioned. So between very large commercial and small local rooftop, that's a very large gap that we've tried to fill here with community solar and storage. So when you have customer choice, in my prior organization, we used to survey low to moderate income households to understand how they wanted to access clean energy bill savings. And it was typically the number one reason why an income qualified household would want solar is for bill savings and bill stability. And then closely, the second reason was to, quote, protect the environment. And what that means is you want to decarbonize your lives or you want to solarize your life. So we have the majority of low income or low to moderate income households and disadvantaged communities in California that want to benefit from bill savings provided by 100% clean energy. And right now they can't, at least not nearly to the scale of the need. So we saw community solar as the perfect fit. And as Stephanie mentioned, you know, I'm from Massachusetts and the fact that they're doing better than us right now is driving me personally insane. And so same with New York. So Massachusetts and New York, California cannot let those two states do better than us at this moment, or really ever. So we are, you know, committed to working through what we have right now to make sure that California continue to be a leader and continue to provide bill savings to low to moderate income households in a much more accessible way. And that is community solar.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's already proven in many other states, as you said, Steve, in New York and Massachusetts, where they've been able to successfully provide electricity to people who weren't able to get it, as you mentioned, low moderate income, and as well as customers who don't have solar on their roof. And it's been to a discount to their electricity rate savings, which is huge. You know, I know you people were mentioning before on this discussion on how obviously with inflation and how expensive things are in California, even electricity rates, like this is a huge way that they could save through community solar. So
yeah, community solar really democratizes solar energy. At the end of the day, that's absolutely key. You know, the U.S. Department of Energy, their goal is to have 20 gigawatts of community solar by 2025, enough energy to power 5 million households and see $1 billion in energy savings for subscribers. Those are ambitious but achievable goals, but we don't get there without California participating in that. And again, California doesn't get there with this proposed decision.
Definitely. And then just going back, this impact California's federal solar for all applications. I know like a lot of states have been using the Solar for All applications to research community solar. Can someone talk to that?
Yeah, absolutely. This does potentially impact our Solar for All application as a state. And I think we were all heartened when California included community solar and storage in their application. But really what the Solar for All dollars are meant to do are really two things. One, drive the capacity of community solar and storage throughout the country, really encouraging that third-party development, whether it's private, nonprofit development of community solar all around the country. The second is to achieve those environmental justice goals spelled out in the Justice 40 initiative at the federal level. Well, the way you do that is to have scalable, functioning, well-articulated community solar programs in states all around the country. If we don't have that in California, if we don't have a program that encourages development, if we don't have a program that really gets those projects up and running so that we can then have those subscriber benefits and bill savings, then we're not going to be competitive versus some of these other states that do have the ability to do that and really access those federal Solar for All dollars. And there's a really good chance that if we were awarded here in California, that money just would not get deployed. You can't deploy money in projects that aren't going to get developed. So it really does impact what our potential is.
That's really helpful. I appreciate you explaining that, Derek. And is there anything else that we haven't spoken about that we should know about? Obviously, we talked about the decision, you know, the community solar program, kind of the next steps going forward. I mean, what's the best way for our audience or our listeners who we call Mavericks to help out, obviously supporting these three great organizations that are lobbying for solar and specifically the community solar program in California that we're talking directly about? Are there other ways, or is that the best way, or just kind of want to, you know?
Sure, I can just jump in quick from Volt Solar's perspective. So as mentioned, Volt Solar is an advocacy organization, and we do coalition building and public engagement. So in this case, there's a lot of good coalition that has gone on and will continue to go on. And then we could use more public engagement. So we'll be leaning on that in this next week and beyond. So I would encourage the Mavericks to go to votesolar.org. And then from there, you know, we have a community solar page. And then from there, you sign up for the email lists. And then that actually directly emails the governor's office, public line, as does the California Public Utilities. If you don't want to do that, I think Google's working real well these days. You can just type in California Community Solar, CPUC, public comment. And then for your listeners, you have to type in a proceeding number, which is A.22.05.022. And so that is the way that Mavericks can write in and share their opinion about California needs and Californians want a community solar program. And you have that golden opportunity right now.
Well, thanks, Steve. That's really helpful. We'll have that on the notes of the podcast as well.
Yeah. And then for solar companies, battery companies, obviously joining SEIA, becoming a member, we work really tirelessly, both at the legislative and regulatory levels to advance policies like this. And we've been in this fight for 2 years. I imagine we'll continue long after whatever happens with this decision, good or bad. So welcome companies, obviously, to join SEIA.
I'll echo that for the Coalition for Community Solar Access. I think we work with partners all around the country in every state where there's either a community solar market or we're trying to get one up and running. We really specialize in developing these broad coalitions. We've had a great track record working with SEIA, with Vote Solar, and so many others in each and every state. And frankly, Benoit, I think we're all looking forward to the movie Top Sun Maverick when that comes out. So it's really excited about that. Thank you for teasing that.
For sure. And then just, I know CCSA has their big event coming up, right? In Denver, Colorado, right? June 13th to the
4th. Yeah, exactly. So we're having our annual climate innovation or community solar innovation summit in Denver, Colorado, June 12th and 13th, and expecting a really good turnout for that. And it's going to be, the time will be right. Visit Denver that time of year. And we're excited to have a record turnout for that and looking forward to some of your callers and listeners join for that event.
And obviously, SEIA has many events coming up. I think they're having an event in Atlanta, Georgia, and you're having the 50th anniversary SEIA celebration sometime in June.
Yep. And then our big A+, which is the big renewable energy conference that's in Anaheim in this September.
Definitely. And we'll have that in the notes of the podcast. I don't know, Steve, do you guys have any events that you want to publicize? Or
we have, I regret to inform your Mavericks, we don't have public events like the other two do. So we're jealous over here. But we do have a lot of public workshops that we give to different utility commissions or grassroots organizations across the country on solar for all or on community solar or on storage and grid reliability. So I would just encourage people to go to votesolar.org to find a calendar of those workshops.
That sounds great. And we'll have that as well on the link of the podcast as well. I appreciate your tireless effort to proliferate solar and storage in California. I appreciate you making time out of your busy schedules. I know it's a crazy time for all of you, and thank you for making time to be on the Solar Maverick podcast.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
Have a great weekend, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Solar Maverick podcast. The Solar Maverick podcast is brought to you by Renew Energy. We're a solar development and consulting firm. If you believe that this podcast is adding value to you, please give us a 5-star review and share with those that you think could benefit from this information. Please email all questions, suggestions, and feedback to info@renewenergy.com. That's info@renewenergy.com. The Solar Maverick podcast is produced by Podcast Laundry and executive produced by Benoit Thanjan and Kevin Y. Brown.